This episode is sponsored by Gel Mix and Purathic. Gel Mix and Purathic are natural thickeners made to support safe, effective feeding at every age. Learn more at gelmix.com.
Happy PFD and Orphan Awareness Month! Presented by B Matters. With host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom. Feeding Does Matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, and I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington. How are you today, Jacqueline?
I am doing really well. Lots of exciting things happening and,
nice.
You know, like back-to-back meetings. So just really, yeah, feeling pretty good. How are you doing?
Same.
Same.
Okay. A lot of that.
Yeah. We just try to get through it all, but love the excitement that comes with it too, which is also what we have today with our guest. So our guest today is Dr. John Leisiker, and he is a director for ethics at Emory University. He is also leading us and has been leading us now for almost a year on our exploration of the ethics work and feeding ethics. And so he has come into this work in kind of outside the feeding world. And I think that's been a really impactful perspective for us as he guides us and facilitates us in conversations in these like shared deliberative conversations that we are having as a field and how to guide the Center for Feeding Ethics work. And so if you don't know much about the Center for Feeding Ethics, that did just launch in collaboration with the Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And you can head to feedingmatters.org to learn more about the Center for Feeding Ethics. But the goal is to really move the field forward and really understand what all of the perspectives are feeling as it relates to ethics in the field. And how can we work on shared deliberation to really understand the values and hopefully move the field towards a shared best practice standpoint. So with that, welcome, John. Excited to have you.
Very happy to be here. Good to see you, Jacqueline. Good to see you, Haley.
So, John, maybe tell us a little bit about how you even got involved with us. Because you come from such an outside world, but I find that so fascinating as well. So maybe share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think Will Sharp reached out to the Marcus Autism Center, saying, hey, is there anyone at Emory? And they'd had good experiences with the Center for Ethics. And I was really brand new as the director. I'd only recently come. And my colleague, Kathy Kinlaw, said that she would go to the meeting. And I just looked at it and I thought it sounded interesting. And I was new. And I was really moved by just the effort of the community to bring together clinicians, patients, former patients, parents, caretakers, and to really try to establish a community of inquiry to move the quality of care forward. And I had just been writing about what this might look like in communities that are dealing with patients diagnosed with and struggling with psychosis. And so Will sent some papers over and I did my homework. And then I found it very interesting, and none of you told me to stop coming. And
no.
I think we worked out a kind of good collaborative partnership. I felt like there was mutual respect and learning. And I'm always drawn to what I consider to be like morally serious ventures. Like, who's willing to really pose the question that challenges their conscience? There's a way in which ethics can be very exotic. You imagine some case that you'll never really be in, or you hope you'll never be in. You wonder whether you can solve the puzzle. And they're the questions that really make us wonder, am I being the best kind of person I can be? Well, I thought that this community was really being honest about the challenges it was facing and the disagreements about how to meet those challenges. And that just excited me and made me want to be a part of it.
Well, that's amazing, John. Haley, it looked like you were about to talk. I didn't want to interrupt
Well,
you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, quite the opposite. Rather than ask you to stop coming, we definitely wanted you to keep coming. We wanted to talk with you more and more. from mm-hmm. every engagement. Because yeah. exactly that. I mean, you were thinking along the same lines that we were. We definitely wanted to move towards improvement in the ways that we were thinking about care.
Yeah. And we kind of get lost in our own world sometimes. And mm-hmm. I think your not only your background and your experience and how you approach ethics in general, but also how you were able to come into the conversation and frame it out and help guide through how we really approach this work in a very meaningful way. I think sometimes anything that we want to undertake at Feeding Matters, we want to do in quality. We don't want to provide lip service to something or just put values up on a wall somewhere. Like, we want them integrated. And so I think you're helping us really add the depth to this level of inquiry that we're trying to accomplish with this work.
Yeah. I mean, this does really resonate with what we've heard from clinicians, because it's very close to everyone's heart. Like, this work is very important to everyone.
Yeah.
And everyone is coming from a place of positive intent. And I think that everyone appreciates the way you approach this with that moral ambition, you know? Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think, no one at a self-interested level wants to break the law because it's costly. And this has led institutionally to lots of cultures of compliance. And the ethics for those cultures often just come down to don't do bad things, don't do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that's not particularly praiseworthy. I mean, it's not blameworthy, mm-hmm. but hopefully we aspire to something more. So I do think cultures of compliance are about avoiding the wrong, and that's absolutely crucial, and that's a key moment. But there's a level of moral maturity, I think, that a person mm-hmm. or a community should hit, where now it's more interested in finding and doing the good. And that then all of a sudden becomes, I don't want to just be a person who doesn't get in trouble. I want to be a person who has transformative impact on the world for the better. And that my own sense of my own success is tied to being that kind of person. And that, to me, at an individual level, at a institutional level, and at a broader civic level, is I'm just much more interested in being among those people and living in that kind of world and being that kind of person. And so I tend now to pick on words like compliance or even civility, because I joke with colleagues, if you said you had a civil conversation, we're just going to think, well, we're glad it didn't come to blows. But it doesn't mean it was transformative or growth oriented or generous. And so mm-hmm. I've really, since taking on this job at the Center for Ethics, really wanting to move the vocabulary and the aspiration into a much greater kind of ambition. And that requires extra work, but I think most people who do the extra work find that it also brings with it extra rewards mm-hmm. that you couldn't have imagined until you got into it.
Yeah.
This is my sort of little phrase. If you become a director of a Center for Ethics, you realize you need your little phrases. but for me, cultures of moral ambition is a very sincere one that's both personal and professional. And I was already feeling that with you all.
That's what I was going to ask about was when you kind of came in, how did you feel? Because we tried to explain what we were trying to do, which was there's a lot of differences in this field and we're really trying, and there's still a lot of for the field to go in terms of there's not really good best practices and there is some history pieces that we need to grapple with. What did you kind of feel as you came into that, especially under that lens of building a culture of moral ambition and really wanting to do good?
Well, there were gestures of inclusion, which was good, but for at certain almost branding levels, you almost need to have something like that. So that could just be compliance. You don't know till you're around folk.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But it was inclusion and also acknowledging that there was genuine disagreement. Mm-hmm. And didn't want to make the disagreement necessarily just go away, but to work through it. That's where I saw the ambition. And that the disagreement might be a site for growth all around rather than just winners and losers.
Yes. So
that's what really got me sort of on board. And I thought, I really want to be a part of this. I want to be, because again, I'd written some things, but they were from the outside. It was like someone who had thought and researched about the difficulties of empowering disenfranchised populations who are diagnosed with a highly stigmatized set of conditions. But it, you know, it wasn't that all of a sudden I had an opportunity to work with a national, you know, international community that was working on this and to be there as it was growing through that. And I just saw the ambition there. And so that made it easy. But again, I think part of the ambition is I disagree with that person and I think they're wrong in a way, but that doesn't mean I don't have something to learn from them.
Yes.
And we're going to have to find a way to work together.
Yes.
And that doesn't just mean blithely agree to disagree.
Right.
It means into it.
Right. Yep.
And then I just like getting into it. I don't like wasting my time. I don't like other people, I don't like wasting their time. Like, if we're really going to talk about it, then
let's talk about it. Let's and I just learn thought, from
yeah,
it.
That's what was really going on at Feeding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the goal too, is we knew that there was this buildup of different perspectives, different camps. I mean, even different diagnoses. And how can we be a place? We've always thought of ourselves as a place of convening. But how can we get into it and have the conversation? And yeah, you may end up in a different space, but it, to your point, even in the keynote that you did at the conference, it's generative and where everybody's learning from it. And it's that community's goal to further this effort by having these tough conversations and being open and curious as to what maybe someone that disagrees with you is thinking.
And you may hear in a resistance to something. There's a truth there, even if you wouldn't have articulated it in the way in which it was articulated. And so I think a good interlocutor is moving between, like, I hear this and I'm on board with this, but then when you put it this way, I feel like that, then the heart of it's lost and it adds these problems that maybe we could dodge or do away with. So I do think, but it also just seemed that people were open and interested to having that. And, I also think at one level, I had been invited in, and once I was in for a while, and then you realize something real is going on, there's a sense of accrued obligation there too.
We did bring you in to really do something. You can't, we can't run right now.
For real.
Yes.
Now we're in. If I thought you guys were jokers, I'd been out earlier.
That's so true, John. You did. You got the opportunity to not only engage in the conversations with us, but also engage with the conversations with the community at large. And that'll be something that, our commitment to all of you that may be listening is these ongoing conversations with John and in these shared deliberative spaces. But you got to witness that at the conference. Anything that you took away from doing your keynote at the conference?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I usually just do in-person things, and so addressing the camera is hard. I inferred mostly from the chat, which was pretty electric, I had done the reading ahead of time, and I was helpfully introduced to some of the questions, and I felt even better about joining the community because there's some receptiveness, there's some resistance, but people were listening and thinking, and it made me really want to be there in person. Like the chat just really wanted me to be in a room with people to ask follow-ups and to see faces and, to hear tone of voice and body language and all the things you need to do to connect to make a difficult conversation not difficult but productive. So mostly I felt enough connection to make me really wish that you know,
that we were in person.
Yeah, in person.
Yeah. Yeah, we hope to make that happen too. One of the things you mentioned during that keynote was about kind of the texture of our interactions. And so I'll just read your quote that now, like, as we're trying to think about that moral ambition and really being that community, you said that now our character brings a texture to our interactions with ourselves and others. So to be with me is to be with a certain kind of texture, how someone enters a room, a tone of voice, the look they give us, the words they choose, whether they call back, whether they answer our emails, whether they think of us ahead of time, how considerate they are. We all have a texture that we bring to the world. And so I'm wondering what kind of texture we need to bring to the world to be the kind of person who lives and works beyond compliance. And in that sense, because language matters, you meant compliance of like just doing what the rules say you need to do.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell me a little bit. Yeah. Give me like a reaction to that, because I think that's a really meaningful place to start conversations like these.
Yeah. So partly the idea that we have a texture, this great British novelist and philosopher Iris Murdoch sort of says ethics is in part about trying to imagine and pursue a certain texture of being. And that really resonated with me because I was always been thinking about, like, the conscientious person wonders, what kind of variable am I in this situation? There are a lot of variables in our action, and I'm now a new one. And I can, you know, help bring things about, you know, slow other things down, prevent other things, introduce new things. I'm not in charge of the situation. So the first one is that I am a variable, a meaningful variable, but I'm in a dynamic set of interactions. Or if we want to be less chemical and more biological, I'm in an ecology. And just at one level, formally, this is just for me the model of what a conscientious person is. And then you want to be literate about who is this person? What are their needs? What's happened to them before? How might they be seeing me? Right? This is why we're imagining a conversation in the future where we ask people to imagine what's it been like for them to go through certain scenarios of care and treatment, and what do they think it's like to be the other person?
Mm-hmm.
And that's me formally through the questioning, trying to stretch conscience to always be moving back and forth. So we do make a difference, and you can do that without being in charge. You know, the pun, if we go back chemical, you are a charge. You are a charge in, right, in the situation. And, you know, then when people are scared and they're suffering and they're worn out, and they really don't even know. I mean, the hardest thing with the young is like going through things without a backdrop of experience. You know, we survive things in part because we've survived them before, right? They get easier. And when you've barely done anything and right, you're suffering and you're surrounded, just like, again, that, you know, part of it is, a key then, I think, to having the kind of texture we want is really being locked in and attentive to nuance and particularities. And this is kind of more Murdoch. Her tension is her main focus. She wants to just say, like, really work on attention and that your ability to, and then we might say more colloquially, being present.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yes.
And then, and to be present in a way that you're able to respond. Because it could also be overwhelming.
Very much so.
Feeling the suffering of others can be completely overwhelming. But depending on the role we're playing, we're not given the opportunity to be it. That's not, you know, that's exactly what we can't be under certain conditions. So then you have to like rise to the occasion. And then the last thing is just there are a lot of variables. You know, who are all the people I'm having to interact? I mean, it's really interesting. Not in all cases, but sometimes treatment is so team-oriented.
Very much. Yeah,
so
I mean,
multidisciplinary.
Really, yes, very multidisciplinary and all different types of teams and what that looks
and
like.
And being sensitive to the expertise and the knowledges and the histories of hierarchies of who's most important and whose voice matters and gender, racial, socioeconomic dynamics. There's so many variables. You know, just that we really are able to read the room as a full diverse, complicated, nuanced room, that changes. You know, just because things were awesome last week, something new may be coming up. Mm-hmm. You know, so you also need to be ready to pivot.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the main thing about the texture is people are going to have a feel for what it's like to be with you. And that texture will make certain things more possible and other things less possible.
Yep.
And there are definitely differences, that I have experienced as a caregiver for a child with feeding differences and as a nurse who's provided care to people and, you know, as a patient myself. I mean, and I think we could probably all identify with this, but I could just tell when someone walks into the room, like when my son has been in the hospital, if this is going to go well or not.
Yeah.
You know, by the way they approach and, you know, if I know they're going to try to do an IV or something, yeah, and just by the way they approach and the way they enter the room, I would say it's their presence or the energy they bring, but sure, texture, you know, like whatever word we're going to use for that, yeah, that way they comport themselves and the way they interact with my neurodivergent child.
Right.
They're going to interact and it could either go well or not so well.
Yeah, I think presence, vibe, energy. I like texture because it could be smooth. It could have friction. There's that whole part. But for me, a good concept ethically, philosophically is one that reanimates something that's been latent already in our ethical repertoire.
Well, I can also see it as being like hard or thick. Like, and maybe being receptive to the other person or not.
Calloused.
Like, you could extend this metaphor to.
Yeah, no,
other
completely.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if we say that was callous, we're saying, mm-hmm, you know, like that's exactly a way of saying it was hard and rough.
Mm-hmm.
You say someone's cold. These are all different ways of. And then it's just trying to bring together. There's so many aspects of us that make a difference that we don't always remain aware of. And that's sort of trying to keep, like, the conscientious person is really trying to think, I'm responsible for the full range of energy and variables that I bring into the room.
Mm-hmm.
And just to have that kind of heightened awareness. And you can't know that ahead of time. You can work it all out to be a kind of person. And then you just got to see how it plays. This is the weird thing. I mean, these are all kind of words for character. And your character is preparation, but it's only preparation. In the end, you execute or you don't. You respond or you don't. You know, you're just really, all of that is about preparation. And then you need to be there. Yeah, Haley.
I can't speak for other disciplines, but I know that within nursing that we do talk about presence and caring presence and how you are when you come into the room with the patient.
To have an awareness of what's going on in the room, it's been a growing trend to really like maybe hone in on that a little bit. It may be different based on different disciplines, but I'm sure it's a component of it.
No, that's great. We're going to have a program with Emory School of Nursing to weave a different virtue into 4 required courses, which would all be like components of this. So it would be like a learning outcome. And it's just, again, like we are asking people to become a certain kind of person. And they're going to, whether we ask them or not. So,
well, that actually... Yeah, no, but that leads me to the next section that I wanted to get to, which was this iterative care and how that kind of shows up in treatment. I know that you spent a lot of time during the keynote really kind of helping people understand what iterative may look like. Maybe give a little bit of that, of if someone doesn't know when you say the word iterative, what that means, and then how we're kind of approaching the work of the Center for Feeding Ethics to be that shared deliberative community towards iterative care. Because it's a lot of words all at once. So I kind of want to slow it down a little bit.
Yeah. So it was a contrast term to discrete interventions. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people imagine medical treatments as, I have a condition, I take a medicine. Or I broke my leg and it gets set.
Right.
And they're sort of one-offs. And if it goes well, then you have a follow-up and it's done. There are other modes of care where the care itself goes through iterations. So the iteration there just means it's going to happen multiple times. And the succeeding ones will have to take into account and grow from the preceding ones. So there's a continuity there. They're not all discrete. Right? The one is, if it's going well, the iteration should build on one another. There's some continuity. There may be differences. There may not be. And so I think when you're in a context of iterative care, you have drawn from and learned from previous visits, but you're also knowing that this person is growing and changing, and we may need to shift. And precisely because things are getting better, right? A certain kind of food is now negotiable. What about another kind of food? That's like almost a perfect example of a growing iteration, right? Every achievement becomes a platform for new possibilities, which bring their own challenges. And to realize that, you know, it's not, if there's a, if you make progress and then run into something, that's not necessarily one step forward, two steps back. That's just the way growth is. That's growth and learning too. Like, yeah. I've learned a language. Oh no, now I, you know, now I can kind of read this thing. And then my language got better. I can read this even bigger thing. You know, another way is there are challenges and opportunities. So it's one way to say we're in for the long haul and things change over the long haul. And growth isn't always linear.
Right.
And growth brings new challenges. And in the thick of those challenges, it's good to remember that we're only here because we're making progress.
Yep.
Yeah.
Does that help make iterative more concrete?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think about it. Yeah, it's a developmental process and it's dynamic. And especially because we're thinking about pediatric feeding disorder and pediatric cases of avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. So it has to be that we're considering the dynamic nature of it, the developmental nature of it. You're caring for a life, right?
Yeah.
This has to be, like John was saying, for the long haul. This isn't hot, you know, it's not a hot potato. Like, this isn't just like, let it go and then forget about it. Like, we need to be nurturing this child within the context of their family and helping everyone along the way.
Yeah.
And yeah, because it is a pediatric situation, it needs to be within the family situation because they're the ones that are going to be the most proximal agents for change within that child's life.
Right. And they'll be changing too.
Right. That's a key difference because they're within the family system. They're integral to that situation, yeah, for that child. That's another thing that's unique. I mean, everyone should be considered within their family when you're talking about a chronic condition, but especially for pediatric cases.
Right.
They're critical.
Yeah. And I was, the only other thing I was going to add is that as the person's changing, that we're remembering there's always a person there in the symptoms and that we're having to relate to both. And, yes, and this is sort of coming out of the work on the tied to psychosis, to not lose someone in their challenges.
Yes.
And that's just a mirror to what we were talking about before. Don't lose someone in our disagreements. Mm-hmm. And now we're saying, don't lose someone in these challenges. And yeah, I think that kind of connection, particularly as it sustains and deepens, helps the the setbacks and, you know, makes the breakthroughs more special because they become really shared at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like what, because you really pulled everybody to be thinking about this like shared deliberative community and being this like humbly curious person to listen first before disagreeing or before that. And I feel like that's that like if you can approach it from a stance of iterative and ongoing development, and it's not going to be linear, but we are going to kind of face this head on and have the conversation, but we're going to be in community with each other, both for the patient in front of us and for the field at large. I thought you did such a good job of like really talking about what that community aspect looks like and your thoughts on community. So maybe share that a little bit too.
Yeah, just that we talked a little bit about this at the beginning in a way.
Oh, yeah,
true. We're not there to win arguments. We're there to learn and to grow. And people are going to put things in their own way because of their training and their background. And then people are going to respond to words they hear in their own way because of their background, their previous experiences, and their reading. And we are in a general cultural moment where words get policed with greater intensity. And that's not a left or right thing. You know, ever since the word liberal became a bad word all the way back in 1992, you know, the culture likes responding in that way. And again, just to be able to always take what someone's saying into a larger frame of morally serious dialogue. And well, why would they have put it that way? What are they getting at that I want to get at too? And maybe that's the right word, or maybe my word's the right word, or maybe neither of us have the right word. And maybe we'll find a word together. Because we're all still responding to this care community and trying to deepen it and intensify its ability to hit the outcomes that the people who enter it want to hit. And I do think that does mean holding each other accountable. And it's okay to say that word, wow, that really rings this way to me. What are you meaning by it?
Leaning into the curiosity piece.
Yeah. Yes. What do you mean by it? That's different than that.
Mm-hmm. Like I'm perceiving it this way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What work does this do for you? Mm-hmm. That's, you know, because I'm worried about the unworking it does in this context.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. And to allow someone to elaborate. Because we often think we know too much about the people around us when they speak to us. And that's the humility and the curiosity as being fundamental virtues or character types of someone. Attention, humility, curiosity, really being fundamental ways to acquire the kind of texture or presence that these complicated situations need and that everyday life needs.
Everyday life.
But these are particularly acute situations.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And that leads us to, as you kind of narrowed in on your keynote, which I'm kind of following the path, but this shift from autonomy and into empowerment. Maybe share a little bit about your thinking on that, because we had a lot of conversations around autonomy and the need for it, but the struggle that the field has with it and some of those things, but how to empower both the patient and the child in the situation and the family and their own informed clinical decision-making.
Yeah. So this was meant to be both an example and a concrete, it's an example of intervening in a conversation where there might be loggerheads that patient autonomy is being violated when the treatment protocol seems particularly invasive and the patient seems particularly resistant. And there's a lot of discussion. I talked to people at the center, and this was a move I generated for the talk. It came out of the language I developed with my brother and working on conditions of psychosis, that the language of trying to empower people to find a life of meaning on their own under conditions of psychosis and against stigma and the like. So But, you know, there are many bioethicists who just say children don't have autonomy, period. The principle doesn't apply. That's too strong.
Yeah.
Because that's going to miss. That's going to shut something down.
Yeah.
People are appealing to that because there's a genuine need.
Right.
And they think this is a way to protect vulnerable populations from undue suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to figure out what the undue suffering is, make sure we're not perpetuating it, and still be able to take some risks in the process of iterative care in the face of some resistances. And this is where being present and having that texture are key, and being able to listen and respond. So my general thought, though, is that, and this came out beautifully at the end of the whole conference, where the woman referring to her child who had undergone things said, "My child now has an autonomous relation to food." And I'm like, I couldn't have planted you. Like, that's the best thing anyone could say, because my suggestion was, we want people who come out of the care to find in food sites of nourishment and potential personal and social pleasure. I hope I got that right. That was me inferring from things I had seen. And also, I do like food. And we want to empower them to get there.
Yeah, and whatever there looks like for them.
Exactly, for them.
Yes.
And where they get to exercise their agency in relation to food in a way that meets their name, right? So we're really trying to develop an agency. And autonomy always leads you to believe the agency is fully formed and you're stomping on it. Mm. And so that's why I resist the word. But I get that the idea is, no, we're harming people. We're creating different kinds of metaphorical and maybe even physical scars that are going to undermine the emergence of that relationship to food.
Yeah.
And so this was the idea: we're empowering a certain relation to food, and we have to be very careful to the disruptions and pain that I think the word autonomy was trying to protect them from, but also realize we're actually aiming at autonomy. We're not beginning in a condition of full autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And my analogy is always, this is the way we relate to school. You know, we have a long way at relating to children in an empowerment mode to allow something like autonomy to appear. And that's a difficult negotiation. And so all the sensitivity that I heard being sought and asked for needs to be acknowledged and respected and worked with. And we got to figure out how to take meaningful but successful risks in the process of iterative care. And we are all actually sharing an idea of autonomy, but it's more the goal than the pre-existing condition.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of, there are different ways of trying to be a philosopher, but this is a way of intervening in a conversation and restructuring it conceptually so everyone's rowing in the same direction. And so that was the goal of that particular intervention.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, kind of, because one of my questions for you was I really want to try to make sure that as we pursue this, we're bringing people along in the conversation with us and really circling back where we need to, or defining concepts where we need to, or using different language where we need to make it more accessible so everyone can row with us together as we pursue this, knowing we don't know where we're going in this. We just know we need to have the conversation now. How do you approach making it not feel so intimidating, or this essence of we've got to get everybody on the bus? Because one of the guiding principles, just in my own life, I'm probably going to mess up the quote, but it's something that I've always thought about in my leadership, which is like, if you get too far ahead of the pack, you start to look like the enemy. And so I've always thought about that in terms of like, we've got to get everybody together. And sometimes that's slowing down to be able to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one is to have as many concrete examples that are close to home.
Yeah.
But I really think with regard, when you're trying to mobilize ethical resources, we're asking people to be considerate, to be courageous, to be kind, to be curious, to be humble. Like we're laying out a horizon of normative expectations. Please be this kind of variable when you enter into this kind of interaction. You can do that in a way by saying, here are the principles you need to live up to, and if you don't, you should feel ashamed. That doesn't work very well. No. Or you can say, through the examples you use, you already have these powers in varying degrees. You can be this kind of person in varying degrees. Let's mobilize that in a particularly acute situation and not oversimplify it and just become one kind of person. You know, either the medical expert or the absolute defender, right, of the child against any of these other interventions. Right, like we're all entering into this collaboration, and what kind of collaborator can we be here? And you know, some days people can just won't be up to their better selves, and we need a little, you know, compassion in those moments. And people need to be able to say, "Sorry, I didn't have it today, did I?" You know, and I think everyone participating can be a slightly more or slightly less positive variable. And we allow room for that. But I think just at the level of vocabulary and the like, is these are everyday words and everyday capacities. We're just trying to intensify things already in ethical life and bring them to bear on this particular challenge. We're not trying to ask people to leave the world they already live and find miraculous ethical principles and apply them here. This is just people working to take care of other people and collaborate in a particularly complicated situation. So that's, I really think, keeping it as something that flows out of ordinary life and will ultimately return. You know, I think if one could become this sort of person in an acute situation, it will morph. Because, you know, there'll be fewer, when things aren't this intense and so much potential suffering on the line, maybe it might be easier to be this kind of person outside those contexts. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I answering the question?
Yeah, it looked like Haley was going to say something too, so I didn't want to jump in too quick.
Well, I mean, do you have a small practical way someone could engage with this project overall? As an example?
Well, I do, if we go to texture, mm-hmm. like that seems, and if we just thought, you know, what kind, just ask, or if people like variable more or presence or energy, any of those words, and to just think, what kind of texture do I have? What kind of variable am I at work? Mm-hmm. And with whom? When am I prickly? When am I patient? When am I attentive? When am I easily distracted? Mm-hmm. And we just sort of follow ourselves around and we wonder, what kind of variable was I in that meeting? Mm. Did I bring zero to the table? You know, I used to have a joke. There's someone who was so withdrawing. I'm like, you know, we'll say his name was Phil. And I'm like, it's the Phil card. You have 10 cards, you get a fill card, and you still have 10 cards. Like, are we bringing absolutely nothing?
Oh, I feel bad for Phil.
Yeah. Well, this was okay. We teased Phil about this to draw Phil into
into the conversation.
We want more of you. You're being too, mm-hmm. too retired.
Yeah. Like, how can we hear from you? What's a way that's a.
I just think what we're asking, this idea of texture and character and these basic virtues.
Yeah.
Are things that apply to every possible situation. I think that's their power.
Yeah.
Is they're not a specialized technical moral discourse.
Yeah.
And they're personal, they're professional, they're civic. They apply in acute situations. They apply in everyday sociality. So mm-hmm. men spreading, right? The people who sit on like buses and trains and take up, they lack the virtue that Aristotle calls friendliness, which is, what is the excellence of dealing in an informal social manner?
Yeah. Well,
not taking up all, you know. So I think I would do, wherever you go, you could wonder what kind of variable. You could ask at the end of the day. But even then, the day is too diverse. I don't think that's going
to
be good.
Yeah, it's almost in the moment, like you said, meeting to meeting, person to person. And that's, yeah. And honestly, that's kind of what we're hoping for in these conversations too. Because I mean, one of the podcasts I had was with Kyler, and we talked about the room of consensus when we do a lot of the consensus work of like who shows up and how they show up geared towards consensus really matters. And what you're asking is like, be thoughtful and be curious about how you're showing up as a means for that iteration, even of yourself or your profession as a clinician.
Yeah, we could drown them in terms, but you know, like,
no, that's what I was trying to prevent too.
curiosity, like, but the words they would use, they would just,
yeah,
who do you want to be in that situation? We give each other five terms we want to be, and then we sort of think about it.
Yeah.
And and I do think patient, humble, curious, compassionate, and generous are five really powerful words.
I agree with you. Those are very powerful words.
If we're with people who are all five of that, an amazing amount of work will get done.
It's in good company.
Yeah.
It is good company. Yeah.
Is that more concrete now?
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the idea if you get too far ahead, you're the enemy.
Oh my gosh, it's served me so well, and it continues to be a reminder that I need to remind myself of, because if you forget it, I really should have it plastered that so I look at it. Yeah. But yeah, it is. It's something I've made mistakes on and I'm trying to like, you know, iterate on.
And then you might not know where you're going, right?
Totally. That's so true. That's another aspect to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. You do need the whole pack to help you there.
Yeah. Well, like, cause otherwise you're not leading the group. You're not even the leader.
You're not the leader once you go that too far ahead. Alone. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Alone.
Yep. You're just alone. Well, in that sense, because we are closing out, I do want to really pivot to the work that we're doing with the Center for Feeding Ethics, which is a lot of this listening and shared deliberation conversations and getting into the room and having the conversation. And so one thing, if you're listening and this work piqued your interest, especially if you have been in the field as a clinician or even as a parent or a caregiver or a person yourself who has gone through this or gone through treatment and you're a little bit older, we really need people at the table with us to do this work. And so we'll make sure we include the link in the show notes for when this podcast comes out. But if you're interested in this work, we do have an interest form on our website to really say, hey, hand up, I want to be a part of this work with you. I think it's really meaningful work. So I do encourage anybody to really sign up for that, because we will be doing a series of focus groups and listening sessions where we've got particular questions that we'll ask focus groups and listen and try to, as John was saying, listen, get themes, reframe, react, those sorts of, have the community react. And as we do this iterative piece. So any final thoughts from John or Haley, or things that I missed as we kind of went through this together today?
Just that we're really hoping to hear, and this is why I named the keynote What Counts as Care, is that people are trying to care and it sometimes doesn't feel like care.
Yeah.
And to know whether you cared for someone adequately, you can't decide on your own.
Yeah.
You need to hear back from them. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is sort of the outreach is just for us to think. And then to have fellow practitioners saying, I would, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? I had this experience. You know, that the real focus is just trying to make the care that's being delivered continue to expand and deepen and enrich and count as care. And where it's not, you need all the people impacted to hear about that.
Mm-hmm.
Although everyone needs to also realize that other people maybe found that accounted as care. And that should be interesting as well. You know, like there's just a lot to listen to and hear, but the goal is to really, make the idea that this is the delivery of care the quality of the care is just thickening and thickening over time because of this kind of community.
Yep. And I'm actually going to read a quote that you had from the keynote because I thought it was so meaningful and powerful as we close out today. It's also a way of saying you matter and we love you. And I think that goal of having the texture to our conduct of convening in conveying to someone when they're resistant, when they're hurting, that they matter, that we care, that we love them, and that they're lovable is a better way to think about how to pursue patient autonomy. And I think you're exactly right. It's the same thing that you just said with us. So, John, really thank you so much for being in this conversation with us in a broad sense with the Center for Feeding Ethics, but also here today with us to our community. This is an ongoing iterative process. So it will be something where we will continue to be engaging with John and having more and more meaningful conversations. And we invite you to those and really want this to be that shared deliberative community. So thank you, John. Thanks, Haley. Always great to see you. And we will see everyone next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone.